Now I want to turn to the issue of the black church and public policy. Peter Parris's classic Black Leaders in Conflict is a clear expose of the multivariate, vigorous struggle of black church leaders to work together on the one public policy endeavor that the black church was instrumental in effectuating, namely the magnificent civil rights struggle. It cannot be denied that the civil rights struggle could not have been won without the active long-term engagement in activism and policy formation mounted by the black church. At the same time, however, it cannot be said that that historic struggle was won solely by the efforts of the black church, as the black masses and other organizations, the NAACP, SNCC, Black Panthers, White Allies, and several other partners all contributed to that struggle. Still, it is not an overstatement to say that this was the black church's most shining moment to date. I'm an optimist. Since the civil rights struggle to make basic changes in public policy regarding legal segregation, there has not been one single issue in public policy that the whole church has been unequivocally for or against, and working for in such a fashion such as to effectuate significant public policy change inuring to the benefit of black people. This state of affairs would not be so problematic if, for instance, the black community had no serious problems that could not be made better by better public policy. Unfortunately, such is not the case. The most pernicious primary problems facing most black Americans, such as poverty, crime, drugs, racism, and unemployment and violence, are complex problems that the black church has not taken any clear, firm advocacy stances for and against in such a fashion that national public policy has shifted clearly in a way that has benefited the black community in general and the black church in particular. Take, for instance, the issue of the death penalty. Many black churches have taken a stance against it, including some black churches, but the black church has never mounted a consistent campaign against it, even though, as most of us know, the system of capital punishment discriminates most clearly and thoroughly against blacks. When the Racial Justice Act, let me just take a quick poll here. How many of you have even ever heard of the Racial Justice Act? Okay, there's a few. Good. When the Racial Justice Act was proposed, an act that would have eliminated the most discriminatory aspects of capital punishment, it was championed by white politicians and received scant support from the black church. Most were not even aware of the fact that it could have minimized the most discriminatory aspects of the policy if the legislation had been passed. Most took absolutely no action in championing its passage, and of course, it failed. Similarly, the ratification of the Equal Rights Amendment did not receive the support of the black church, which by and large was hostile or indifferent to its passage, even though its ratification would have made it illegal to pay women less money for the same work as men, and more black women work to support black households than other American households, and those same households are more dependent upon their wages than the households of the greater populace. So we got hurt worse by the failure of the Equal Rights Amendment. These two examples of clearly discriminatory public policy practices that have not been rigorously opposed by the black church illustrate the basic thesis of this paper. Namely, that since the Basic Voting Rights Act and anti-discrimination victories of the historic civil rights struggle, the black church has taken no consistent monolithic position of advocacy for any public policy position. Further, it would not be unfair to say that the black church does not understand itself as having failed in completing its mission and failing to do otherwise. Said another way, the black church no longer sees itself as a primary player in the struggle to change America. But now I'm speaking of the black church in a monolithic way. That is to say, there are, of course, several black ministers who are working assiduously and well for public policy changes. What has changed is not the heroism of individual leaders, but the lack of consensus of the black church behind them. Take, for instance, a brief comparison between Reverend Adam Clayton Powell Jr. and the Reverend Floyd Flake. In fact, the last time I spoke here at Vanderbilt was in 91 with Reverend Flake. Both served in Congress. Both pastored very large and influential churches with vibrant ministries. Reverend Flake still does. But Powell worked for a previously mentioned civil rights agenda. And even though he had enemies, he had support for the furtherance of that agenda. Reverend Flake retired from Congress, has a great ministry as well as running a college, but never could command the consensus of the black church that Powell had. In no way is this assessment any negative reflection on Reverend Flake. The problem is not with Reverend Flake. The problem is with the black church. It has changed. First, we no longer have a monolithic black church. This is true in part because we no longer have a monolithic black community. And that again goes back to the issue of, you know, for some black folks in some areas, hey, having a big prison, that's a source of good jobs. You know, we have a growing black middle class that now sees itself as having different needs than the black poor. Public policy formation, and in particular major changes in public policy that might inure to the benefit of black people, requires massive support. Yet that support is absent. Why? Well, one reason is the black church is stuck with furthering continuing battles for further improvements in the civil rights agenda. Take, for example, the issue of affirmative action. The black church is loosely in favor of affirmative action. It is a form of reparative justice that is morally defensible, yet is not particularly popular. It is unpopular because, in part, it seems to disadvantage most clearly white men. Yet its primary beneficiaries have been white women. White women have advanced more swiftly than the economy has grown. Accordingly, resentment has set in as competition for desirable offices and advantages are waged. Interestingly enough, however, the ongoing racism of America has required that the resentment to affirmative action frequently focuses on racial and ethnic minorities rather than the primary beneficiaries, i.e. white women. But lest we get off the track, there is a bigger problem in the continued skirmishes for affirmative action than the growing tide of resentment. I owe my first hire in academia to affirmative action, and that is part of the problem. Affirmative action is a morally justifiable form of reparative justice, but it tends to benefit the most advantaged members of the victims of distributive justice. A young black male without a high school diploma is now the most disadvantaged person in our society. Most of us know the statistics that document the problems of young brothers, the astronomical unemployment rates, the rates of incarceration, which we just heard about, rates of drug addiction, rates of HIV/AIDS infection, rates of violent deaths, and rates of gang involvement. Another statistic that is equally troubling is the current low rate of membership in the black church. Most of us who know these statistics shake our heads and intone solemnly that if more black males, young black males, were in the black church, fewer of them will be contributing to these pathological statistics. While such observations may be true, there are indeed statistics that do indicate much lower rates of pathology for black male churchgoers. Nevertheless, such observations miss one crucial point. The black church prides itself as being the institution in our society that is designed to help the African American community, and particularly the most distressed members of our community. Yet it is this very same church that fails to even try to advance public policy changes that would most help young black males. In other words, young black males are failing to attend the most prominent institution in their society that also consistently fails to attempt to address their non-religious needs. Surprise, surprise, surprise. It is no wonder that young black males no longer feel so compelled to be members. In our church, we sing, "I'd rather have Jesus than silver and gold." But such hymns are much easier to sing when you have some modicum of silver and gold. In short, the African American church is failing in its mission to serve Jesus Christ when it fails to address the least of these that Jesus died to serve. Deacon's pantries will not help masses of young black men find careers and fulfillment in the 21st century. I do suggest you go see The Pursuit of Happiness, in which you do see Cecil Williams and Glide Memorial doing a wonderful job. That's a wonderful thing they're doing. And it's a good thing they are doing it, because we're not doing much for public policy for young black males. So praise God for Cecil Williams and Glide Memorial. However, as a consequence, the black church becomes increasingly viewed by the black community as becoming increasingly unimportant in the affairs and life of the community. Further, when the African American church does attend to certain crucial public policy concerns, frequently it does so in ways that must, in the final analysis, be considered ineffectual at best, if not hostile at worst. Take, for instance, the issue of urban public education. I myself am a product of the Newark public school system. no private schools till college. It is not a bold assertion that if more black youth were better educated, they would do fewer drugs, commit fewer crimes, have higher rates of college education, have better paying jobs, contract fewer venereal diseases, and provide better marriage choices for black females. In short, most of the pathological statistics associated with young black disconnected males can be traced back to their functioning poorly and ineffectually in our society due to their economic non-sustainability due to the miseducation of the Negro. Okay? Yet the response in the black church has not been outrage or marches for better schools. Rather, our churches have either started charter schools or supported vouchers for educational choice. Both of these responses are defective because of the issue of scale of improvement. That is to say that both approaches help the most advantaged, best connected members of our society, and only a few of them at that. They're like affirmative action in that regard. Unfortunately, the masses of miseducated youth are left to their own devices. Again, to be perfectly clear, I'm not arguing against the establishment and operation of Christian schools. I am criticizing the notion that such institutions adequately address the problem of dysfunctional mass urban education. I hope you see that distinction. So my fuller thesis for this paper should now be apparent. It is this. Historically, the black church was a powerful change agent in the struggle for progressive public policy when it acted en masse in the civil rights struggle. Since that time, it has continued to fight skirmishes for a variety of scraps for the most advantaged members of our society in areas like affirmative action. Its historic success as a change agent was due, however, in part on its acting en masse for changes in public policy which it had a consensus on as being unjust. Since that time, the primary problems in the black community, such as poverty, unemployment, crime, drugs, and AIDS, have not been advanced by the African American church. I mean that again monolithically. This failure is due in part because of its commitment to the old agenda, and in part because of a lack of consensus as to what public policy changes should be made. What, however, is at all important about the failure of the black church to promote progressive public policy? Everything. Much of the criticism of the African American community has been leveled at aspects of its dysfunctionality that has been attributed to its cultural and moral insufficiencies. Take, for instance, the problem of female-headed households mired in poverty. It is true that many poor black families are female-headed, but as William Julius Wilson has demonstrated, the practice of bearing children out of wedlock is a post-1945 phenomenon that is attributable to the economic movement of our society from an industrial one to a technical information-based one, coupled with the outmigration of jobs, industrial and otherwise, to suburbs and exurbs, resulting in fewer favorable marriage prospects for urban black females. These society-wide industrial, economic, and political changes in our society simply cannot be attributed to a change in the ethical teachings of the black church or in the alleged moral slippage of black women. Most in the academy argue, like Wilson, against the culture of dependency theorists who blame the victims of bad public policy for the results generated by bad public policy. Wilson's prescriptions for changing these outcomes may be flawed, but they are not that the black church has lost its spirituality or that the black church has adopted a new and defective sexual ethic. Wilson argues not for changes in the black church, but changes in public policy. In this respect, he is, of course, correct. Our society cannot be changed merely by more revivals. And I say that with no denigration of the African American church. I'm ordained myself. I'm an associate minister in the church. I preach about once a month. So I'm deeply connected to the church. But you can't make some of the changes we need to make merely by revivals, but by major changes in public policy. Accordingly, what the black church needs to do is to come together en masse to champion new public policy initiatives. Ah, but what public policy changes should be made? Wilson has argued for changes in public policy that do not single out black people and young black men as their primary beneficiaries. He does this not because he believes such parties are not deserving of public policy changes in their favor. He advocates general changes in economic planning that benefit all poor people and urban people in particular because he does not want to generate resistance to the ameliorative public policy changes due to issues of racism. Accordingly, Wilson has advocated public policy changes that fly beneath the radar screen of American racism. This approach might work, but it has not done so as of yet. I believe that perhaps a more direct approach might work better. I conclude this essay with an explanation of the importance of advocacy and solidarity. Who speaks for young, disaffected black males? Public policy discussion and implementation is generally based upon changes to be made that benefit the public in general first and only secondarily help individual groups, especially those that have specialized needs or that face unusual impediments to achieving success. This is why Wilson advocates, as he does, for general change over particular change. Public policy achieves consensus by providing concessions, changes, and relief to broad concerns for the mass middle class or politically connected special interests, i.e., the super wealthy. Groups that get serviced are those who have lobbyists, such as large corporations or the wealthiest, who has as de facto lobbyists, i.e., elected officials. I can't hear you out there. Lights, can you help me? Because I think you need to hear that one. All right. For example, the recent discussion raised passing new minimum wage laws, one of few policy moves that would have directly benefited underclass isolated black males, among many others, was initially sabotaged by Republicans, who tied its passage to other votes for the continuation of extensive tax cuts that benefit only the super wealthy, whose numerical representation is small, but whose political pull is huge. The wealthy did not need the additional tax cuts for survival, while poor people, of course, needed the minimum wage raise for survival. As a result of the delay in passing this legislation, the poor suffer hugely due to continued inflation and the continued falling buying power of wages. They continue to lose economic ground to the middle class, and the super wealthy still make more money, albeit perhaps a little more slowly. Even with the recent election, raising the minimum wage has been a struggle as the lobbyists for the wealthy, the Republican Party, continues to demand tax concessions in the Senate for the passage of the minimum wage hike. We should be outraged at that. Most proposed policy changes to be made, even for poor people, will, however, focus on female-headed households and the working poor of nuclear families, not disaffected black youth. Why? Let's be honest. The latter groups are more politically palatable. That is, they generate more goodwill and action than others. Crips and Bloods don't pose sympathetic figures. While this focus is sensible in terms of exploiting natural sympathy, it fails to address the question as to what group needs public policy intervention more. Who has the fewest advocates to champion their needs? What group is most dislocated in terms of most social community goods? Who are the most forgotten of the so-called underclass? Thus, young black men have no effective advocates to speak for them with regard to public policy. Their disproportionate influence in cultural trend setting, i.e. hip-hop music, sports, entertainment, etc., does not create opportunities except for the tiniest elite among them. Jay-Z, P. Diddy, LeBron James, and others may serve as positive role models for the 0.00000001% of young black males who may succeed them. Further, these cultural icons who may be said to speak for and to young black males do not advocate for major public policy changes that will help their followers. Is this their job? Perhaps not. Why should LeBron James be an expert on public policy? If it is not their job, however, then whose job is it? Much has been made about the recent remarks of Bill Cosby with regard to the problems of disaffected black youth. Whether Cosby is right or wrong cannot be discussed herein. What must be noted about that discussion is the fact that the focus of change in that discussion is upon the unsuccessful working to improve themselves, rather than an admission that their needs need to be addressed by their self-improvement as well as the effectuation of major public policy changes with regard, in particular, public education. In other words, black youth need to improve their lots by self-help and public policy changes that help them. To help them must be achieved. Yet our current reality is that their needs and concerns are addressed, if at all, as the unintended side effects of policies designed to help other groups. Accordingly, until young black males can make recognizable claims on the Commonwealth that the Commonwealth understands to be legitimate and important to at least discuss, The continued failure of public policy to address the real needs of young black males will remain unaddressed and unfulfilled. This is where, however, the black church cannot go wrong. The black church can stand in solidarity with disaffected black youth, regardless of the unpopularity of such a stance. To stand in solidarity with poor black youth may not immediately set a new course of action in new and ameliorative public policy changes, but that is not the point. It could move discussions in a new direction and effectuate some changes. But more importantly, advocacy for and solidarity with young, poor black males will send an unambiguous message to them that the church cares for them, and therefore God does also. Standing in solidarity with them and advocating with and for them makes it clear to them that they are not forgotten. It makes it clear to them that they matter. And it sends a message to the rest of the world that these people are valued by the church and God, even if they are not by anyone else. It is only when the black church takes a new approach to advocating new public policy concerns that it is at all likely that it can further its most important agenda, namely serving Jesus Christ and the world. Indeed, a new and healthy relationship with young black males helps to solve many of the church's problems, namely having more members, having marriageable partners for black women, and having a balanced population of lay leaders. Yet to change the current situation will require the church to make the first changes. And To change the current situation will require the church to make the first changes. Black males will not uncritically return en masse to our current church. We do not have a friendly atmosphere ready for them. We have taken the position that they need to change and come to us. The reality is, however, as a people who are supposed to be empowered by the Holy Spirit, it is we, the church, that must make the first move and change with the intention and hope that our recognition and suffering with black males will convince them that we want them and not just their tithes. This is the challenge before the church. I close with this observation. Why should our racist, sexist, economically exploitative society cherish and work with young black males if we do not? Finally, when public policy is focused on young unemployed black males, it has consistently concerned itself with our pathologies. The negative ratio of black men in college compared to those in prisons, the failure to turn poor public educations into exciting careers, our failure to establish nuclear families when chronically unemployed. In short, our defects and failures, rather than the skills and positive attributes of this class of our community, have been featured. So we have this, the most negative image of African-American people, and no longer the welfare mother, it's, the disaffected African-American male youth. We know that this sad story is not the primary story and the only story, but we must share the other side. For if we do not, no one else will. No one else will do our jobs for us. Let those who have ears to hear, hear. Thank you.